Okay, so this is the session on the resistance to the Nazis in Germany. We're very lucky to have Janie Stone come to speak today, and what's going to be an audiovisual extravaganza as well for us all. Janie is a longtime socialist. She was a founding member, actually, of the predecessor organization of Socialist Alternative. She's a supporter of Socialist Alternative today, and she's always had a big interest in Germany and these kinds of questions. So I'll pass straight over to her. Just a reminder to people, if you have questions, comments or anything like that, save them up for the end. We'll have a bit of time at the end for them. So I'll pass over to Janie. Oh, can everyone turn their phones off, sorry.
Und eine Trommel und hinten eine Fahn, in der Mitte einen Sarg man trug. Zu Potsdam unter den Eichen, im hundertjährigen Schein.
A song written by Brecht and with music by Kurt Vile, sung by Ute Lemper. And it was actually first performed in 1929, and yet it has all the right mood as to what's coming, was what was coming. Now, in this talk, I'm just going to start out by saying what I'm not going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about the Second World War or the reasons for it at all. Can everybody hear me, by the way?
Yep.
Good. I'm not going to talk about the nature of fascism. I'm not going to talk about the Holocaust. I'm not going to talk about the issue of whether we should or should not have supported the Allies in the war. I'm not going to talk about what I've just shown you in that slideshow, the failure of the Communist Party and the Socialist Party to prevent the fascists coming to power. So I'm going to talk about something different, because we're used to thinking of fascist governments as omnipotent. And in fact, as we know, the repression of class conflict is one of their primary functions, and the Nazi machine was one of the most efficient at doing this. So a question that might come to your mind is, what could we have done about it? You know, was there any possibility of resistance? Was resistance futile, as has been put in another context? So really, was the only hope going to be in the Germans being defeated militarily by the Allies? Now, probably everybody knows that a lot of people, in fact, 3 million Germans ended up in concentration camps or in prison. 3 million ended up there for political reasons by 1945, and hundreds of thousands of people died. Now, of course, this shows the power of the Nazi state. But it doesn't only show that. It actually shows something else. it indicates the strength of the opposition. That many people were sufficiently oppositional to be taken up and incarcerated by the Nazis. And it occurred in spite of that deterrent. So that's what I'm going to talk about today, about the opposition and resistance to the Nazis within Germany by the Germans. And I'm talking about resistance by ordinary people, resistance from below. Now, I'm just going to go very quickly through what are two of the best-known oppositional groups, and one of them, most of you have probably heard of, was known as the White Rose. This was a group of mainly students and academics in Munich, and they were intellectuals and committed Christians. They put out, I think, four or might have been six leaflets during the time they were operational up to about 1941-42. And their leaflets were in a very high-flown style. They tended to quote the Bible, Aristotle and Goethe, being intellectuals as they were. Their leading members were Sophie and Hans Scholl and Christoph Pabst, and they were arrested while distributing leaflets in February 1943 and were executed. Now, at least three films and one opera have been made about the activities of this group. And you can see why, because in a way they embody the most romantic ideas of resistance to the Nazis, a small group of dedicated freedom fighters who made the ultimate sacrifice, perfect opera material. Now, there were a number of groups around, communists and social democrats, and probably again the best known of them is known as the Red Orchestra. You see the names they had. Actually, that was the Nazi name for them, the Red Orchestra. They didn't call themselves that, but that's what we've come down to posterity is named. Now, there were about 150 people in the Red Orchestra, the grouping that was known as the Red Orchestra, and there was more than one group, actually, various oppositional groups at different times around Arvid Harnack and Harrow Schulze-Boysen and others. Very small, tight-knit groups focus on secrecy. And initially, their main activity was to try and re-establish contact with each other and to establish little secret cells and to make groups. They did put out leaflets. They did provide some support for the victims of Nazis, for Jews, for prisoners of war, for forced labourers. But also, their main strategic focus was to establish contact with the Russians. Now, being communists, that made sense because the Communist Party at that time did have a focus on Russia. But seeing they were in wartime, the other thing they did after they established contact with the Russians was to provide information. That is, they acted as spies. Now, this was bound to bring down the wrath of the Nazi machine on them, and it did. In 1942, of those 150, 126 were arrested, and a number of others were just murdered without even bothering to, Nazis didn't even bother to arrest them. So, that put an end to this particular grouping's activities. But the other thing I want to say about their activities is that having established links with Russia, they then, as good communists, proceeded to receive instructions from Russia, and apparently a lot of these instructions were highly unrealistic. This guy, Wilhelm Knöchel, who wasn't in the Red Orchestra, he had his own grouping, wasn't a formal member of the Communist Party, he was an independent communist. He had links with workers in the Ruhr district and was, as I said, an independent communist. He wrote in one of his letters that commented on how unrealistic the instructions from Moscow were. And he says, are the people in Moscow on the moon? Because apparently the Russians were wanting them to run a tightly knit cater group. Now, this is in conditions of Nazi Germany where that was simply not possible. Another grouping from the time got together in 1942 to produce these stickers. The Nazis had one of their propaganda exhibitions called the Soviet Paradise. They produced this sticker, which says, permanent exhibition, the Nazi paradise, war, hunger, lies, Gestapo, how much longer? So these people who did this action in 1942 were rounded up not long after and executed in 1943. So groups such as these, the White Rose, the Red Orchestra, these groups, and the many other small resistance groups that were operating at the time, idealistic, romantic maybe, like the White Rose, or spies like the Red Orchestra, or the assassination conspiracies like the von Grafenberg attempt to kill Hitler in 1944. All these things, they make terrific TV. They make terrific films. They make terrific programs of all sorts. But these groups who did this, they were necessarily rather small, and in particular, because of the nature of what they did and what anybody was doing, they were small and they were clandestine and restricted to very tight-knit groups. Now, these are groups that people know about, but most people don't know, is that opposition to the Nazis was far more widespread, and it wasn't just these tight-knit cells and small groups. And that's what I'm going to go on to now. Now, when Hitler came to power, he had detailed plans for youth. And in fact, he wanted a paramilitary organisation to totally brainwash and subjugate young people to prevent them any independent thought, much less serious opposition. So he established, by the end of the 1930s, the Hitler Youth and the League of German Girls, separate organisations. Of course, we don't want the sexes mixing. So by the end of the 1930s, they were the only legal youth organisations. And that's their propaganda images of what they were supposed to be like. Our youth, this is Hitler, our youth must learn nothing else but only to think and act like Germans. And if they still retain smudges of class consciousness or aloofness from Germandom, then the armed forces will deal with them. And the Hitler Youth, a youth organisation, teenagers, they even had their own police squad consisting of some of their own members to supervise other young people. Now, that was the propaganda, this is the reality, and you can see how regimented and militarist they are, but you can also see they're not exactly happy and smiling, or anything like that, way up in the top right-hand corner where they're not particularly excited about this. So you can understand why young people resented all this, and there were, in fact, a large number of oppositional groupings. And the first one I'm going to talk about were known collectively as the Edelweiss Pirates. There was a lot of groups with groups, different names in different cities, but they were particularly in the industrial regions of the Rhine and the Ruhr. And you see very sharp contrast in image, hanging out, hands in pockets. And you see why this would appeal to young people, not only in the Nazi period, but at any period. As one of the Edelweiss Pirates from Cologne said, we weren't academics, we were out of the streets. Quite a contrast to the White Rose group. Mm-hmm. Now, like young people at all times, they like to wear distinctive clothing, and this is what was ultra cool in the late 1930s and the early 40s. Ultra cool. Now, a lot of these groups developed out of really hiking clubs, actually. And so, as hiking, because it enabled them to get away from the cities and away from supervision, so what was cool was to wear ski shirts for the boys, neckerchiefs and shorts, but they also went in for things like skull rings and belts with studs. The girls also wore unapproved clothing. If you remember from the previous picture of the League of German Girls, their skirts were very long, whereas these girls are wearing skirts above the knees, which is pretty provocative, and also long hair. Now, the reason they were called the Edelweiss Pirates is because they wore a badge with an Edelweiss on it. Now, some of you may be under the illusion that the Edelweiss, the flower, the Edelweiss, was a symbol of mass opposition to the Nazis among the Austrian aristocracy. Anybody think that? You know, the song, which I'm sure everybody could join in singing if I was to encourage you now. Well, in fact, the Austrian aristocracy, surprise, surprise, were not a leader of opposition to the Nazis. And they did not participate in the Edelweiss Pirates. In fact, it was a very clever choice of symbol because I was surprised to discover this. The Edelweiss was Hitler's favourite flower. So if you wore a badge with the Edelweiss on it, you couldn't be arrested for wearing that badge. So it was a very clever trick to identify themselves to each other. So in the early days, their main aim was to escape Hitler Youth and go out hiking and so on, sing rebellious songs. But once the war started, their oppositional stance led to more politicised activities, and they're actually best known for their fights with the Hitler Youth, which were actually very successful. A report from the Nazis sent to the Gestapo officers said, I therefore request that the police ensure that this riffraff is dealt with once and for all. The Hitler youth are taking their lives into their hands when they go out into the streets. Isn't that fantastic? The Hitler youth were afraid to go into the streets. And there were some streets that were no-go areas for the Hitler youth. And I really think we must recognise that as a real achievement. Now, the leaflets this group produced were short and to the point. They were very provocative too. So it's brown as shit. That's how brown cologne is. Wake up. That's what their white leaflets look like. Again, very difficult, different to the white rose, fanciful. Another leaflet, away with the brown horde. We will die in this misery. The world isn't our world anymore. We must fight for another world. Short to the point, very catchy. They also painted slogans on walls. Down with Nazi brutality, medals for murder, that one hung Navajos, Navajos being the name of one of the well-known groups. And they managed in 1942 to paint their slogans on the headquarters of the Gestapo. Now, I'm coming to a second of them getting arrested, but this was actually written on a prison wall, very defiant. Kids must go into the war, wheels must roll for victory, heads must roll after the war. So, the major group, they also did other activities like listening to foreign radio and putting the information into their leaflets, and they also helped Jews and forced labourers. Now, this is the most interesting group, the group in Cologne, where there were approximately 3,000 of them. And in fact, a youth worker noted, they are everywhere. There are more of them than there are Hitler youth. They beat up the patrols because there are so many of them, and they never take no for an answer. Now, in 1941, the Nazis started a policy of arrest and prison and torture. They used to round them up, beat them up, and then send them off to concentration camp or death sentences. And as the conflict with the Gestapo grew more serious, the Edelweiss pirates also stopped up the ante, and they started raiding army camps to obtain arms and carry out various other illegal activities to get money. And they were able to move their targets beyond the Hitler Youth, and they actually managed to knock off the head of the Cologne Gestapo in this period. So, not surprisingly, the Nazis were very serious about them as well. Now here I have, this is one of their parody songs, and you can see that's a picture of a Gestapo prison where you can see the person in that prison wrote the name of that song up on the wall. So they were still taking their rebellion with them into prison. Now the Ehrenfeld group were one of the groups in Cologne, and under the leadership of a man called, a man called Hans Steinbrück. And in 1944, this group was based in a working class area of Cologne, and not only did it include the young people, teenagers, 16, 17, 18, it also included concentration camps, escapees. Actually, Hans himself was an escapee from concentration camp, and also included forced labourers, Jews and deserters. So really, everything that the Nazis hated were in this group. They then set out with a plan to blow up the Cologne Gestapo headquarters. Now, unfortunately, the Gestapo found out about this plan before they were able to put it into action, and they arrested a group of the 13 leaders in October 1944, including Hans and a number of other young people, and they were hanged in the street. And that's another of the guys who was hanged, Barton Schink. And he was only 16, so this is the age of the group that did this. So this group was criticised during the period and in the post-war period for being rowdies, for just being for adventure, desire to destroy, and even for their criminality. Their role was not recognised. I mean, later on, there were excuses like they weren't definitively political or they didn't act out of high ethical or political conviction. I mean, it's incredible. And they were not recognised as resistance fighters till 2005. So I just want to go on to another youth group called the Swing Youth. Very different style from the Edelweiss Pirates. Now, jazz and swing music were very popular with young people throughout Europe during this whole period, but the trend of popularity of swing music and swing dance took on the character of a protest movement in Germany. Now, again, it was the Nazis that called them the Swing Jugend, Swing Youth, but they took the name to themselves. They thought, this is a terrific name. Now, this is one of their parodies. Because they were against the Nazis, again, because of the militarism and the conformity. Short hair, big ears, that's how the Hitler Youth were born. Long hair, tango steps, the Hitler Youth don't join in that. Oh ho, oh ho, you hear it in every corner, the Hitler Youth must be done away with. It doesn't rhyme because it's my translation. thank you. So they were opposed to the Nazis because of their ideology, conformity and their militarism, and above all because of restrictions on personal freedom. And they expressed their rebellion not by beating up the Nazis, but through music and dance. Now, of course, they had their own clothing styles as well. And you remember the boys in the Hitler Youth wore just shorts and plain brown shirts, and girls and boys had to have short hair, the boys had short hair and the girls plaits. Now, the swing boys, I found different descriptions of them, and it's pretty weird. They had whips of long hair combed backwards with brilliantine or sugar water, so that if they danced, they could whip around. They wore American-style zoot suits. They were very, being at a swing, they were interested in foreign music, you see. American-style zoot suits, or baggy deep-rise trousers with turned-up cuffs and ostentatious shoes with very bright but strong crepe soles. Or American double-breasted suits with very wide lapels. Or a lot of them went in for the English style, and that's what you've got here, plaid suits with umbrellas and a foreign daily newspaper rolled up. And I mean, that was ultra cool. Another way of being ultra cool. Well, young people always pick what's ultra cool is what's the opposite of what your parents want, isn't it? So the girls, what was really distinguished them was that they wore makeup, long hair or curl in perms, penciled eyebrows, lipstick and nail polish. So the thing is, I just want to say briefly, is the style of dance. So I'm going to show you what some swing dance, and I'm not going to do this personally, although I could actually, but I don't have a partner, but I'm going to go to a video in a second. But the point about the swing dance is that you see how you have to do it like this. It's bent over. And swing and jazz, of course, has black roots. It's got African roots. And it's also a style of music. Swing, the songs, came from America, from Hollywood. And many of the composers and songwriters in America at that time were Jewish. So this is this Jewish black American import. We can see why the Nazis didn't like that. In fact, they called it degenerate. Probably you've heard about the Nazi exhibition of degenerate art. And this is the musical equivalent of degenerate art. And they talked about it being rooted in black jungle music. Here's a quote. You could compare them to the war dancers of hysterical Negroes. And they carried on about the dance style not being normal, because, of course, traditional German folk dancing is very upright, river dance style, very upright knees and all that stuff. But this is bent over with the upper body hanging down loosely, loose hair in their faces and bent knees. And this is actually a cartoon from the time, the bottom right one. The left is a parody of a guy doing the dancing, and the right-hand side is how he's going to end up being a prisoner in the same posture and also sweating. So I'm just going to show you here briefly. Now, the video I'm going to show is, we don't have any genuine footage from Germany from the swing kids dancing, but what I have here is from a film made about these kids. So it's got the period costumes and styles and the dancing that they would have done.
Thank you.
see why the kids enjoyed doing that. You can see how much fun it is, but you can also see why the Nazis didn't like it. Really wild, really expressive. And did you see that woman going like that? Really sexy, the exact opposite of everything the Nazis stood for. And this sexiness, it particularly upset the Nazis. They were carrying on about these private dance parties, unlawful jamborees full of sexual mischief, house parties with girls who were seduced into freely participating in random intercourse. So it's got everything. It's got everything the Nazis hated: sexuality, admiration for the enemies, England and America, refusal to participate in the Hitler Youth, and refusal to comply with Nazi law, because, in fact, after 1940, young people under 16 weren't supposed to be outside after dark. So this doesn't sound political, but the thing is, the Nazis themselves politicised it. See, we have to understand what the definition of political is. Those kids doing that today, which you can see that sort of dancing today, it's not political. But in that period, at that time, it was highly politicised, and the Nazi regime took it seriously. They carried on about the selfish impulse to amuse themselves, but rapidly deteriorate into antisocial criminal gangs. And in Hamburg was a centre of this dance style and the swing youth, and they received special attention from the SS, who wanted to deal with the ringleaders. And Himmler said "My judgment is that the whole evil must be radically exterminated now. It is only with the utmost brutality that we will be able to avert the dangerous spread of Anglophile tendencies." So, I'm not sure what date, I've written the wrong date here. They arrested over 300 people, I think it might have been in 1941 or 42. The leaders were sent to various concentration camps, and the under 18 were sent to special youth concentration camps. And even when they're in concentration camp, they were irrepressible. Here's a satirical verse about two people. One was an SS guard who was called Big Paul, and one was from the Gestapo called the Fox. "First Big Paul breaks all your bones, then you crawl on all fours before the Fox. He makes fricassee out of you and minced meat out of your tail. Then you pipe out of your hind parts the very last fart. Swing high." So this is these arrests, in fact, only furthered the politicisation of the remainder, who then started to distribute anti-fascist propaganda. And the boys here in this concentration camp at Moringen were categorised as political prisoners. This was a youth detention camp. And they used to sing popular swing songs when they were in concentration camp. They were also sent off to forced labour. And this is the arrest order from Günter Disher, who survived the war. And here's a quote from him from what they did when they were sent off to forced labour. "The salt mine where we worked," it wasn't really a salt mine, he's just talking about how bad it was. "The salt mine where we worked had really nice acoustics. One of us played on the cartridges. These were like wooden boxes, and he would play drums with some sticks. We improvised all sorts of things. Sometimes it sounded horrible." So there they were in concentration camp doing forced labour, playing a sort of a percussion ensemble to keep their spirits up. So that's the youth. And I just want to come to some examples, first of all, on the topic of anti-Semitism, which I don't have much time to go into. How's my time? That's not fine at all. I'm going to have to go quite quickly through this, and I'm very sorry. Well, what should I do, actually? I've got about another 20 minutes to go. You're the chair. The
people have spoken. It just means we won't have much time for discussion. But
just keep going. I'm sorry, everybody. This is a topic I hate it when it does that. You don't have to do anything with these little netbooks. You just have to breathe on them. As I said, I won't be able to go into the Holocaust at all, but I just want to say very briefly. I'll have to leave it there. I'm just going to talk about a couple of examples. Most people know that quite a lot of Jews, in fact, did survive the war through support they got from Germans and others. And I'm just going to give two examples of it. People have probably heard of the Horst Wessel song. Horst Wessel was a 22-year-old Nazi stormtrooper who was murdered in 1930, and the Nazis made a martyr out of him, and the Horst Wessel song became one of the Nazi anthems. But I was astonished to discover Horst Wessel had a childhood friend named Margot who was Jewish. Margot and her husband survived the entire war in Berlin due to aid given to them by Horst Wessel's sister. Isn't that amazing? Now, this one here, this is a workshop you can still see in Berlin. Otto Weidt, who was not Jewish, had a brush factory, and he employed primarily or almost exclusively blind and disabled Jewish workers through the late 30s and into the early 40s. There he is in the top right, and in the top left is the outside of the factory, and it looks very similar today. You can go and see the place. The bottom slide shows a sort of separated area where he also hid a family for as long as he was able to. The next is so there's a picture of all the workers there. Another incident that perhaps many people haven't heard is in Rosenstrasse, where when the Jews were rounded up in February 1943 during the final solution, there were included 2,000 men who were husbands of Jewish women. And they were kept in a building which was in this street. These non-Jewish women, who were the wives of these 2,000 men, spontaneously in February 1942 gathered in a spontaneous demonstration in front of the building, and they remained there for several days in spite of efforts to disperse them. One of the participants said, it was as dark as a lake with heads, thousands of heads. The SS aimed their machine guns at us. They didn't actually fire, but they did their best to intimidate. And the Nazis capitulated. They released those 2,000 men after several days. This was the only public protest against the deportation of the Jews. Just a couple of other things on everyday resistance. People probably know about the Nazi plan to exterminate the mentally and physically disabled people, and 70,000 people were killed between 1939 and 41. There was so much unrest about this policy throughout the regions and towns of Germany. For instance, in a town in Württemberg, there was so much opposition that Himmler was forced to close down the extermination centre. And it was so widespread that in the opposition that in the end Goebbels ended the program, or Goebbels and Hitler halted the program because they were afraid to lose the support of the regional people who were the agricultural workers that they needed during the war. And lastly here, approximately about 2 million Germans listened to foreign radio regularly during the war. And again, I need to point out that you could be severely punished for listening to foreign radio. It was not political today, but it was then. And you've got this terrific poster here. You've got this sort of Marxist Bolshevik-looking chap up there speaking into the radio microphone, you know, from places like Moscow or London. And down the bottom, I hope you can see it, there's a very sneaky German, obviously aware that he's being a criminal by listening to his radio in the dark. So I now want to come to what's in some ways the most important part of this talk, and that's opposition among workers. Now, when I started doing this talk, I assumed that there would not have been any strikes or anything like that. So I just prepared the talk, and then I thought, well, I'd better just look. And lo and behold, I found an incredible amount of material. Now, the Nazis used a combination of legislation and coercion to contain the working class, and they had the philosophy, the concept called Volksgemeinschaft, which means community, and the idea was that everyone's the same and there's no longer any class conflict. So we know the independent trade unions were replaced by the Nazi Labour Front, and all the trade union leadership and all the communists and social democratic, all the leftist parties, people end up, their leadership end up in concentration camps or worse. So we have a police state there. And many factories actually had concentration camps attached to them. And by the time the war came around, things got even worse. In Volkswagen factory during the war, there was a whole network of informers, and there was a factory guard consisting of SS men who patrolled the factory corridors and floors with guns and dogs, arresting workers for the slightest infraction of rules, and then beating them up, and then confined them in the factory cellars and sent off to a workers' punishment camp. So this is what workers were working under, the conditions they were working under. So you can imagine the activities available to them were rather limited. But that doesn't mean class struggle went away. The British historian Tim Mason says, classes did not cease to exist just because the word was formally banned. Now, in the early part of the 30s, when the Nazis first came to power in 33, there was mass unemployment. But once they started rearming and the economy picked up, and by the late 1930s, there was actually a labour shortage. So, unbelievably, we obviously don't have comprehensive statistics on the strikes that went on, but there is some information from the Nazis themselves. And for instance, between February 1936 and July 1937, the fascist officials listed over 200 work stoppages. Most of them were small and lasted only a very short time, but as Mason said, in the light of the prohibition on strikes, of the permanent repression and surveillance, and of the fact that there's no doubt that the Gestapo would arrest strikers, it called for a very high degree of determination and solidarity to down tools. And in fact, there were over 11,500 people arrested, 609 trials and 3,000 sentences. And the amazing thing is that often these strikes were successful. For instance, they often didn't even need to go on strike as such. In the building industry, for instance, they used to collectively threatened to all resign and go and look for another job, and that was sufficient to increase their wages. So wages was a really important issue during this period in the late 30s and in the early 40s. One of the interesting features was how the workers were able to utilise the Nazi henchmen on the shop floor. So the Nazis were there, the SS were there, but the class struggle did go on. For instance, there was a strike at a glass factory in 1937 where members of the SS joined the 150 strikers. In the coal mines and the printing and paper industries of the Ruhr district, which was a major industrial area, the officials of the Nazi Labour Front were forced to act as spokesmen for the workers in relation to wage claims. They wanted a wage claim and they said, this is the only organisation we have, you're going to have to be our representatives. There was another case in 1938 where there was a supervisor in a large firm. Now, he was responsible for implementing their policy of cutting the piece rates, and he was a member of the SA. Well, there were rank-and-file SA members in that same shop floor, and they said to him, either you don't implement this policy, don't cut our wages, or you resign from the SA. Class struggle operating through the structures that were there. And, in fact, they were so successful that wages rose for 3 years in between about 36 and 39. Nonetheless, the state attempted to control the wage rises, and there was an attempt to reduce wages in 1938. Now, in firms where wages actually were reduced, there was an almost across-the-board fall in output, and Mason says it's as if workers on time rates wanted to cut their productivity by the same amount as their wages had been cut. And he calls this a striking testimony to the durability of trade union solidarities. Now, these strikes and strike-like actions weren't the only things. This is a terrific example. In 1938, in the BMW factory in Munich, they were having an air raid practice, and all the workers were sent down to the bunkers below the factory. While they were in the bunkers, they discovered that there were hidden exits from this bunker, and they all left the factory in droves. 1938, making for home and saying, "We don't want a war." And in 1938, they also introduced civil conscription to compel workers to take particular jobs, and often they had to be sent away from home. Well, even this also was met with major opposition. For example, there was a group of workers who were being sent off from Berlin to go and build the Siegfried Line, which most people have probably heard of. This was in Berlin. They were at the railway station in Berlin to get on the train. Their wives demonstrated. There was a demonstration against the civil conscription. And in fact, many of the conscripts failed to turn up at their new workplaces. And productivity was so low anyway that many employers wouldn't even use the conscripts. And in the end, they had to withdraw the measure. And there was a similar event in 1939 when there was an attempt to cut wages and curtail a lot of conditions. And this again produced a massive wave of absenteeism, which failed. But nonetheless failed, and they had to withdraw the measures. I'm being told I'm up to 40 minutes, about 5 minutes. Thank you. I'm very sorry about this. Now, one of the major techniques they used was absenteeism. There was, for instance, in a Berlin armaments factory in 1939, 20% of the workers were missing on the day after payday each week. And there was, in an explosives factory in 1940, this is under war conditions, in this explosives factory in Nuremberg, 400 out of 2,000 women regularly missed work on Mondays and Tuesdays. And there's another factory where, on a daily basis, 300 out of 1,800 were absent. There's also a whole lot of other things I don't have time to go into. Refusal to work overtime, carelessness, which may well have been industrial sabotage, and so on. And it generally seems very likely that with all of this, that there was a certain level of collusion. It wasn't just individuals just doing their own thing. Even though their leadership had gone, many of these workers were experienced trade unionists experienced trade unionists on the shop floor, and you can't drive those ideas that easily out of people's heads. Just to wind up here, this is a picture originally intended as a propaganda picture, a bunch of workers. And I see everybody's red. They're all giving the Nazi salute, but they're all got a bold fist in their pocket at the same time. Now, this was supposed to be a propaganda picture, but I think it's a terrific picture for our side to show that the workers, to survive, had to make a few gestures, but in reality, they were still oppositional. So just to finish up here, I want to make four quick points. Firstly, the class struggle was still alive. Secondly, we hear often that it was all Germans who were responsible for the war. And I say this, and that we heard about German exceptionalism. And in fact, there have been books published saying that Germans were responsible for the Holocaust, the Germans were Hitler's willing executioners. These are nationalist arguments. The Germans, even under fascism, were not one class. There were different people with different, who took a different stand in relation to Nazism. Thirdly, I'll come in when I do my final sum up, and in fact, I think I'll leave my last 2 points till after the discussion. I just want to wind up with one last track, which not quite yet, I'll just say what it is. The reason I'm playing this is you would not think this was a political song. The thing is that these girls, I mentioned before the swing boys when they were in concentration camps, the swing girls used to sing to the other the other women there in concentration camp. And what did they pick to sing, among other things, by Mir bist du schön, an American song written by a Jew with Yiddish words in it. And these people sat there and were comforted by it. And I'm just going to wrap up with that song now. Thank you.